This was not Trump versus Harris. This was Trump versus Harris and ABC News.
All right. The 2024 election is kicked off. We had our first debate with Kamala Harris, Donald Trump. A lot of information to digest from what happened in the debate. A lot of people are wondering if we're headed for a meltdown at this point. We've got Jim Rickards on the line. Jim, give us your update. What do we need to know about this debate? What were the pros and cons? Who's winning? And what's going to happen?
Great. Actually, there's a lot to say, Matt. We'll go through it for our viewers and our readers. First thing I want to say is everybody in the world says Kamala Harris won, except maybe one other guy. I looked at his column this morning. So if you want, I'm sure everyone's seen, the headlines or their favorite website or, new show, or whatever. But everyone says Kamala Harris won. I think Trump won. I'll explain that because, you can't be like a total outlier and not offer an explanation. But the universal consensus is she won. Why does everyone think that? A couple of reasons. Number one, certainly as far as the media is concerned, they're all very pro-Harris anyway, overwhelmingly. Not exclusively, Trump has his corner, so to speak, but the media is overwhelmingly pro-Kamala Harris, so it suits them to say she won. Number two, the bar was extremely low, practically, it's like the limbo rock, practically on the floor. And that's because she cannot speak extemporaneously. And I'll come back to that and how it played into the debate. She can't answer questions. She either needs a teleprompter, notes. They're calling Tim Walz a support animal because she needs him around. And kind of muddles through it, but she says things. They're juvenile, they're infantile, they're circular, they're repetitive. They make no sense. She's been doing that all along. She cannot speak extemporaneously, so the bar was like really low. And then she passed that. She did better than what I just described. So right there, when you set the bar, we like to think our candidates are up here. They set the bar down here. She was probably not quite in the middle, but she passed the low bar. So the fact that they like her anyway, where they support her, the fact that she did exceed expectations, and a couple other things that I would say Trump didn't do as well as he could have. So that was enough to develop this consensus that Kamala Harris won. So let me, we'll expand on that, but let me give a different view, my own view, and I can say one or two others. Number one, nobody won. And what I mean by that is there's no official score. It's not a boxing match. You go to a professional boxing match, there are three scorers who sit at ringside, and they score the match. And if somebody gets knocked out, okay, the other guy wins. But if not, they just add up the points and they award. They say somebody won. They call it a technical knockout where you didn't actually knock them out, but you got more points. That's a system. There's no system like that for this. So there was no... When everyone's got an opinion, from the New York Times to the Washington Post, and I do as well, but we're all just expressing our views or opinions. A lot of them come with a heavy bias. So technically, nobody won because there's no official scorekeeper. Consensus-wise, media-wise, Kamala Harris won. That's very clear. Let me explain why I think Trump actually won. A couple of reasons. Number one, I spent a lot of time, decades really, studying communications theory. And one thing I know about television, or for that, video, or actually what we're doing here, is that people don't listen very much to what the person's saying, whether it's to debate or a panel on TV or any content in the media. People actually don't really listen to the words. What they do is they watch. They look at the speaker, they form an opinion, they look at your demeanor, very subjective, but very kind of almost, kind of subconscious, but they form views on the person, and they ask themselves the following question, is this person being straight with me, or is she lying? Is this person speaking from the heart, being honest? It doesn't mean you're right about everything, but, sincere, are they fake? Are they speaking to me, or are they kind of speaking down to me? And it's kind of a condescending way, but basically it kind of boils down to, do I trust the person or not? That's what people are actually thinking when they, even at a subconscious level, when they're watching something like this. And so, did she score some points? Yeah, she was very good at baiting Trump, meaning she was trained, in her preparation and so forth, to come up with four or five lines that were designed to trigger Trump. Now, I'm sure Trump's, training camp said, don't get triggered, but you can't help it, or at least Trump can't help it. So she talked about the crowd sizes at his rally. Now, well, that's not relevant to policy. What does that have to do with, Ukraine or inflation or the economy or tariffs or job? It doesn't have anything to do with any of those things. But it was designed to trigger Trump because Trump has this kind of obsession with crowd sizes, starting with his own inauguration and the size of his rallies versus the size of her rallies, et cetera. So she threw that out there. Now, what Trump should have done is just pivot. In other words, say, oh, you want to talk about the size of my crowds of my rallies? Let's talk about the 11 million people who came across the border illegally and are, raping and stealing and robbing and shooting and taking American jobs, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, don't take the bait. Just take the comment, pivot to something that's very much in your favor. And in Trump's case, the immigration issue is very much in his favor. He didn't do that. He said, my crowds are bigger than your crowds, and you can't even get a crowd, and you got to bus them in. But my people, they come. So he started talking about the crowds. Well, notice he took the bait. That's a completely non-substantive thing, but she was trying to throw that out there. Trump will take the bait, but Trump wasted. First of all, nobody cares, okay, except Trump. And then he wasted 3 or 4 minutes of valuable time. They only had 90 minutes and a couple of commercial breaks, and the moderators took up time. So he kind of wasted some valuable time when he could have pivoted to immigration, for example, and that would have scored a lot more points. So he did take the bait. But beyond that, if you look at what she actually said, so much of it fell into a couple of different categories. They were either platitudes, and I have a few notes, just because I want to, if I'm going to do quotes, I want to get them right. She said, we need to move forward. She said that three or four times. She said, we need to turn the page. She said that a lot. She got into this thing, well known, it's well known that you do this, and it's well known that you do that, and it's well known that you're a racist, et cetera. She repeated that five times. That was kind of the well-known stage. She was talking about the war in Gaza with Israel and Hamas. She said, this war must end. Okay. She didn't say how. By the way, the two-state solution that she talked about, that's been on the table since 1917 in the Balfour Declaration, when it was British Palestine, or the Palestinian Mandate later after World War I. So the two-state solution has been out there since 1917, 107 years. But suddenly she's got the two-state solution. Anyway, let's see, I'm just looking at my notes. Standing as America always should. Standing as America always should. What does that mean? A cliche. She talked about a new generation of leadership for our country. She's been the vice president for almost 4 years, but somehow this is a new generation. I have a plan. She said that six times. I have a plan for this. I have a plan for that. I have a plan for lower drug prices. I have a plan to get grocery prices under control, et cetera. Never said what the plan was. And by the way, the only plan she'd announced was she's going to stop price gouging by, big corporate supermarkets. My first job when I was, or my second job, when I was 15 years old, I used to work in a supermarket stocking shelves. The one thing I learned about the supermarket business, they work on a 1% margin, 1%. So if they do $100 gross, they make a buck. The idea that they're price gouging is ridiculous. There is inflation, but it's not because of greed by supermarkets working at 1% margins. So my point being, her entire debate performance was, I would break it down into kind of three categories. Baiting Donald Trump, all prearranged, scripted in effect. Platitudes and cliches, which sound good very superficially, but they're like, okay, well, what is the plan, or how are you going to do it, or you say you're going to do this, you haven't told us how. It's not even on their website. And then just these rehearsed modules. She cannot speak extemporaneously. That hasn't changed, that she's not that bright. But she's talented enough to memorize stuff. And so when you listen to it, I mean, play it back if you want to kind of zero in on this stuff. If you listen to it, they were all written by, professional writers and consultants. She memorized them. Okay, I'll give her credit for that. She's good at that. But she was sitting there, obviously concentrating, trying to get these things out in a row. But they were all like, she didn't have a teleprompter, but she kind of had one in her head, which is they said, you need to say this. It's a 2-minute module. Here you go. Say it 50 times. You'll probably get it right. Don't talk about, big yellow school buses or whatever else she's been talking about publicly. So she was either baiting Donald Trump, completely scripted and memorized, or spoken platitudes. So in the, when you watch it, you're like, well, okay, she didn't fall down. She didn't babble. She didn't talk the way she usually does in an unscripted moment. So again, this goes back to setting the bar low, and then she outperformed. So that's the basis for saying she won. But it's not, as a voter, as a citizen, you have to ask yourself, did she give me a reason to vote for her? Did she articulate she says she has a vision, but did she articulate a vision? And the answer is no. So it was just, it was like eating potato chips, the kind of, and you keep doing it, but there's no nutritional value, is one way to put it. So I would say it was a very, it exceeded expectations. The universal view is she won, but that was based on setting the bar really low. Now over to Trump. He did allow himself to get rattled. His weakest moment came toward the end when the anchors, by the way, just to digress for a second on the economic, this was not Trump versus Harris. This was Trump versus Harris and ABC News. They were totally on her side. And when you say that, you sound like you're whining. Oh, you lost her. You're whining about it. No, I mean, I'm an analyst. I'll be objective about it. In particular, the fact that they fact checked Trump. Now, they didn't get their facts right, but that doesn't matter. You actually said this, So they were fact checking. They never fact checked her. The questions were, questions that really held Trump's feet to the fire. Do you regret anything you did on January 6th, as implying that he was an insurrectionist? Do you regret certain things you said? But they never asked her, for example, hey, President Biden, people forget he's still the president, even though he's lying on the beach in Rehoboth, Delaware. President Biden's been senile for 4 years, not like the last 4 weeks or 4 months. It's 4 years. Hey, Madam Vice President and Mrs. Harris or whatever, why did you cover that up? Why were you part of a concerted effort to say he's sharp as a tack? You couldn't possibly keep up with him. The guy works us to death. He never stops working. Those were all lies. Why did you say that about him when, in fact, he was so senile that you had to do a coup d'etat and throw him off the ticket? That would be a tough question, but they didn't ask that, and that's my point, which is they were zinging Trump on how are you going to deport 11 million people? I would have said a million at a time. Let's get started. But the questions were, they went right at issues that are tough ones for Trump, but did not kind of zero in on her. So there's a lot of bias. I mean, it's kind of obvious and you expect it, but it was there anyway, and it had some impact. So Trump, I thought his weakest moment, one of the anchors said, I don't know the woman's name, but she was kind of pushing him on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and you want to replace it. Well, what's your plan? And they never asked. By the way, they never asked Kamala Harris what her plan was. She said, I have a plan for this, I have a plan for that. Nobody ever said, well, what is the plan? That question was not asked. But they turned to Trump and said, well, what is your plan for affordable care? And he said, well, and he stumbled a little bit. He said, well, we have a concept of a plan. Well, actually, if you've ever been in business management or political management or political consulting or anything of the kind, or anything where you're in charge, that's how ideas evolve. You get some smart people in a room, you exchange ideas. You go further, some you shoot down. You develop the concept, turn it into a plan, and then you articulate it, then you put it out there. That's how planning works, with a lot of iterations. So Trump wasn't wrong, but he missed an opportunity to say, we'll be announcing that plan in the next, 2 weeks, but you can count on the fact that it's going to be better than what we have now. That would have been the right answer, but he kind of said, well, she said, what's the plan? What's the plan? Well, we have a concept of a plan. A weak moment for Trump. So he did get angry. He did take the bait. He did miss a few opportunities. Having said that, he did hit his points, and he nailed her on the Afghanistan withdrawal. He nailed her on, he came up with a new phrase, migrant crime. That is the first time I'd heard that. Obviously, the illegal immigrants are committing crimes all over the country, but he kind of branded it migrant crime. He talked about weaponizing the Justice Department, the fake cases coming out of the election in 2020. But that was, by the way, that was another whole avenue where they hit him really hard. Do you still say that the election was stolen? And Trump said, yeah. And he goes, well, you lost every case. There were 15 court cases. None of those cases remedied the or dealt directly with the allegations or remedied the actual cheating that was going on in 2020. Now, I followed those cases at the time, and I'm a lawyer, so I know how to read opinions and interpret them. And Trump was right. They did lose 15 cases, but why did they lose them? None of those cases went to the substance. None of those cases looked at, ballots in Maricopa County, Arizona, that were put in boxes and warehouses and never counted, or mystery suitcases full of pre-printed ballots that were pulled out from under tables at 3 in the morning in Atlanta, Georgia, or the fact that the poll watchers in Philadelphia were required to keep 10 feet away from the people counting the ballots because of COVID. But I don't care if you're Superman, nobody can read fine print from a distance of 10 feet. You can't do it. So they couldn't actually do their jobs. That was going on all over the place. None of that was addressed in these court cases. Now, again, going back to 2020, what the court said was you don't have standing, meaning, maybe somebody can bring this lawsuit, but not you. You're not in the right jurisdiction. There was also a contradiction, which they said, well, you're bringing the case too late. If this is your issue, you should have brought it in March or April of 2020, not after the election or during the election itself. But they did bring them in March of 2020, and they were at the time they were dismissed. They said, well, no, you got to wait till the election. So which is it? The cases that were filed 6 months in advance, the courts threw them out because they said, you got to wait till you have actual wrongdoing. And then when the wrongdoing occurred, they brought cases, and the court said, no, you should have brought that up 6 months ago. So what it boils down to, by the way, is that the courts hate these cases. The courts do not want to be involved in election cases. They say it's between the legislature and the voters and the citizens. And if you think your county commissioner is, rigging the vote, vote them out. If you think your secretary of state is, certifying fake election results, vote her out. In other words, this is between the voters and the legislatures, or the elected officials. The courts want to keep out of it. They still feel burned by Bush versus Gore in 2000. They don't want a repetition of that. So the courts did everything possible using what's called laches, which is a Latin term, means you waited too long, jurisdiction, standing, all these procedural things, and then threw those cases out. None of those cases, not one of them, ever got to the facts alleged. So Trump was right about that. But what are you going to do on a debate, in a live debate on ABC News when you have 90 minutes? Give people a law lecture? I just gave our audience a law lecture, but I'm sure people can follow it. But an example of the anchors, the moderators, hitting Trump with a question that he couldn't possibly answer in like less than 15 minutes, and Trump's not a lawyer. And it's like, you lost every court case. So there, the anchors are taking. So why are the anchors saying that? Maybe Kamala Harris could say it if she wanted to. She's the debate opponent. But as I say, it was Trump versus Harris, Trump versus the moderator. So they ganged up on him. They baited him. They threw him hard questions. They threw her softballs. Everything was rigged against him. Okay. I want to kind of come back to why I think Trump won. When I go back, going back to what I said earlier, that people watch, they don't listen. I mean, they do listen, but not really. They're really one. Really, Trump had a pretty good appearance. He was not the orange man. He got a little Botox. That's fine. You're on TV, it doesn't hurt. So he got some Botox, kind of took out some of the wrinkles. His hair was not orange; it was blonde. By the way, they all dye their hair. So this, I'm not picking on Trump. I'm just telling you a little bit of stagecraft. His comb over thing, whatever. That was styled a little bit better. So better styling, better hair color. He had a tan, but it was a real tan. It actually looked kind of good. It wasn't like a there's one of those tanning parlor fake tans with that whatever where they paint you orange. So he often in the past, he has been the orange man. His hair is kind of orange. His face is kind of orange. He wasn't. It was the hair color was a blonde. The hairstylist did a good job. He had some Botox. He had a natural looking tan. He looked a lot better. So that's good. This is the kind of thing that people, again, they internalize subconsciously. Kamala, was she making her points? Yes, again, cliches and platitudes, but she was making her points. But she was strident, more so than Trump. She has a nasal kind of voice like that, and very high pitched. It was really nails on a blackboard. I mean, again, vote for whomever you want and take whatever side you want. But that voice, which you don't hear very much because she doesn't do interviews and she doesn't do anything other than a teleprompter stump speech, it was kind of nails on a blackboard, and people noticed that. So I would say in terms of visual appearance, demeanor, pitch, tone, things like that, which are not trivial, they actually matter. Trump came off much more solid than she did. Let me just finish with she did cackle once. I got to look up the name of the actress who played the Wicked Witch of the West and Wizard of Oz, because she kind of comes off like that without the hat. But I just want to again go down my list. Yeah, Trump did Afghanistan, did inflation, destroying the fabric of the country, weaponized the Justice Department. He made the point that she was a failed border czar. He did talk about illegal immigrants when she was talking about the January 6th defendant. Trump said, "Why are we prosecuting January 6th, but we're not prosecuting illegal aliens?" Good point. Made the point that Nancy Pelosi was responsible for January 6th, which is true. Let me see. He didn't back down on the 2020 election. He said she got zero votes, which is true. She ran in zero primaries, which is true. They're supposed to be, the Democrats are supposed to be the defenders of democracy, and Trump's a threat to democracy. They just shredded democracy. They just handpicked her with no votes, no primaries. It was the most undemocratic process you can think of. I thought Trump was very strong on Iran. Iran is financing the Houthis, the Hezbollah, and Hamas, the three, two Shiite, one Sunni, militant terrorist threats to Israel, are all being financed by Iran. And he said Iran was broke under Donald Trump, which is true. I'm an expert on economic sanctions, and I did this kind of work for the intelligence community, CIA, and others. I know a lot about it. And Iran was broke. So I think that was not only right, but Trump made that point. On Ukraine, this was interesting to me because she hit him pretty hard, and then the host, of course, amplified it. They asked Trump three times, "Do you want Russia to win?" I thought his answer was a good one. He said, "I want the war to be over. I want people to stop being killed." It wasn't about Russia winning or Ukraine winning. It was about, can we get the war over and stop killing people? That's real. That's substantive. I thought Trump articulated that very well. But they kept baiting him. "Well, do you want Putin to win?" And then, of course, Kamala Harris comes in. "If Trump's president, Putin's going to be in Kiev." Kiev, she said. Putin's going to be in Kiev. And then look out Poland, because Poland will be next. None of that's true, by the way, but those are the talking points. And by the way, just as a quick aside, this debate was not really about the country as a whole, the popular vote, the electoral vote, etc. This debate was about Pennsylvania. It's a national broadcast, national audience. I get it. They talked about a lot of policy things, but this was all about Pennsylvania because, and that, by the way, that's why you heard so much about fracking. And I'll come back to a couple other issues. But if Trump Arizona and Georgia, and I think he's well positioned to do that, and wins Pennsylvania, he wins. He wins the election. He's got to flip Arizona and Georgia from 2020. But if he does that and takes Pennsylvania, he wins. If Kamala Harris takes Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, she wins. Even if Trump gets Georgia and Arizona, we'll be in our newsletter, Strategic Intelligence. We've already covered this. We'll be talking about some more in the coming issues. But she has almost no path to victory without Pennsylvania. Trump has almost no path to victory without Pennsylvania. So I'm overstating it a little bit. There are some alternatives. But basically, whoever gets Pennsylvania wins. So that's why you heard so much about fracking. I was born in Pennsylvania. I went to law school in Philadelphia. I root for the Phillies and the Eagles, so I've got some Pennsylvania chops I can lay claim to. That's why you heard so much about fracking. It's a big deal in Pennsylvania. And then she said, when they were talking about Ukraine, to Trump, by the way, what are you going to say when Putin takes Kiev and he's looking at Poland? What are you going to say to the 800,000 voters of Polish descent in Pennsylvania? Well, there actually are 800,000 voters or some large number of Polish descent in Pennsylvania. It has a large Polish community. So, but those are the illustrations of how this whole thing was really about Pennsylvania, even though they didn't advertise it as such. But I thought Trump's answer was really thoughtful and the right answer, which is, look, what are we doing there? Why are we spending $250 to $275 billion fighting a war that has nothing to do with us? And they say, well, you're defending democracy. It's not a democracy. I mean, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, was elected over 4 years ago in a rigged election, but leave that to one side. He won a 4-year term. His term expired last May. May 2024 was the end of Zelensky's term. Why is he still the president? They didn't have any new elections. Well, I can tell you the answer. He declared martial law, he suspended elections, and he is a military dictator, a dictator. And Putin said, I won't negotiate. I might negotiate with Ukraine, but I'm not going to negotiate with Zelensky because he's a military dictator. He's not duly elected anything. Democracy is dead in Ukraine, but you still get, by the way, most people don't know that, but that's the case. But you still get this, oh, we're fighting for democracy. No, we're not. We're fighting for a military dictator who's skimmed billions of dollars, bought houses in Dubai and Miami. He'll be on the first plane out when the curtain comes down on the bogus government there. But the moderators kept saying, do you want Putin to win or do you want Ukraine to win? That's a false dichotomy. You create a binary choice. Say, you want Putin or Zelensky? What is it? That's not how the world works. There's like a million gradations in between. How about a peace treaty where, both sides agree the fighting's over, Russia keeps Donbass and Crimea, Ukraine keeps the rest, Ukraine's neutral, they don't join NATO. That's a compromise. That's somewhere between a pure Putin victory and a pure Zelensky victory. That's how wars end in most cases, not all. I mean, World War II is different, but the idea that there could be a negotiation and who would be the best negotiator and who could actually put that together, that was never put on the table except by Trump, who said, he said, I'm not picking sides. I just want this thing to be over. Very thoughtful answer, but kind of went right over everybody's head, and he was sort of branded as pro-Putin. But this is just Russia, Russia, Russia all over again. So, and then Trump talked about close to World War III, not a talking point. We actually are close to World War III, closer than we've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's an extremely dangerous state of affairs. You've got nuclear armed powers on both sides, and Biden, he's still the president, although she's around. They escalate, escalate, escalate. And we are getting close to a nuclear war in Ukraine and in Israel and the Middle East. So I think Trump scored some very powerful points through the fog of her platitudes, her baiting, him taking the bait, moderators ganging up on Trump, fact-checking Trump, not fact-checking her, et cetera. So that's kind of my summary of the debate. But if you want to know who won, Matt, I'll tell you right now. We'll know this coming Friday or Saturday over the weekend. Why do I say that? Because the only thing that matters really is the final vote, and the polls. Okay. So My opinion, I just gave it. Other people's opinion, they all think she won. Okay, that's what the headlines say. Got it. But there is no official score except one, the voters. And so we'll see what happens on, by the way, I'm not going to say we'll see what happens on election day. This election is going to be over by October 15th because most 2/3 of the voters are voting early. So we're in the real-time election right now. People are filling out their mail-in ballots and putting them in the drop boxes, or they're faking them, or whatever's going on. But we'll look at the polls this weekend. Polls have been beginning with the coup d'etat when they threw Biden under the bus. Then it was like Queen Kamala, coronation of Kamala Harris. Her polls went up. Yes, they did. Some pollsters stopped taking polls because they're like, hey, we got a good print. Let's just wait 3 weeks and let everyone think she's still ahead, even if she isn't. But now we're getting new polls. Things were trending in the past week. Things were trending in Trump's direction. Still close, but this is close. No two ways about it. But the Kamala honeymoon was over. Things were trending in Trump's direction. Let's see what happens Friday. My expectation is that that trend will continue because I think people will internalize the substance, notwithstanding the cosmetics. If you see a big surge in Kamala, then I'm wrong. But I'm willing to wait till Friday or Saturday. I'm willing to be judged by the polls, but my expectation is that Trump is going to continue to gather strength.
Yeah, well said. Couple questions for you. In
Sure.
between now and the election, it does sound like, right, polls are open. We've got, mail-in ballots, all sorts of stuff happening. It's not really a one-day election. It's a month and a half or whatever. In
That's right.
between now and the election, is there anything big, any other big milestones or anything else that you see happening? Because this debate, we were waiting for it. This is a huge one in between now and the election, but anything else that you see coming up that we should keep our eye on?
Yes, two big ones that have nothing to do with the political debate, but that will affect the outcome. The first one is Ukraine. We talked about Ukraine. Russia is rolling up victories much faster and of more significance than Americans realize. I don't expect Americans to be able to, recite the names of 15 Ukrainian villages, but people do read the headlines, the New York Times or the Washington Post or NBC News or whatever, or Fox. And it's not being reported because there's been a continual propaganda campaign to say, Ukraine's using the wonder weapons. They got F-16s. By the way, the F-16s are being shot down. And then she went through that. She said, well, we gave them the Bradley fighting vehicles, Abrams tanks, Stinger missiles. We did. And they all failed. The Bradley tanks are burning on the battlefield. The Bradley fighting vehicles are burning on the battlefield. The Abrams tanks are burning on the battlefield. The F-16s are being shot down. The HIMARS precision guided artillery is hitting empty cornfields because the Russians figured out how to jam the GPS. And none of those weapons are working, which should disturb NATO. Forget about Ukraine. But Russia is taking, you hear these names, like, are they taking Kiev now? They may not have to. But these towns you've never heard of that are major logistics hubs, you got to study the battle space. Look at the railroad lines, the major highways, the rivers, etc. And there are certain towns or large towns, small cities, whatever you want to call them, that are key hubs. Russia is taking those. Once you do, you meaning the Ukrainian armed forces, cannot resupply these other outposts, these other fortresses, because you've taken the transportation hub. There's no way to get there. And so that's going on. The Kursk invasion of, hey, Ukraine invaded Russia. Well, again, you got to know the geography. The part of Russia that they invaded, and they did, they took some territory. It's forests and dirt roads. I mean, they didn't get anything of significance. They didn't get anywhere near the Kursk nuclear power plant, which was the original objective. That failed. They've now been surrounded. And they're going to be annihilated. They're going to have two choices, surrender or die. But the Russians aren't there yet. But what I just described, Matt, is going to, by October 1st, mark it down. That's going to be the beginning of a major offensive, really, the annihilation of the troops in Russia, which are, by the way, their best reserves. When those troops surrender or are killed, Ukraine will have no reserves. And then on the battlefront in Donbass itself, moving towards the Dnieper River, Russia is rolling up Vuhledar and other key logistics hubs, and there are going to be major advances. And the ability of Ukraine to hold out is going to be, which is will evaporate basically, and it'll be very, very clear. The other one, we have a little friend called The Economy, and sorry, Federal Reserve, sorry, White House. The economy is bigger than all those things. The Fed is basically kind of a puppet show. I mean, they come out, now they're cutting rates. They're going to cut rates September 18th. We've already, told our readers about that. Everyone thinks it's stimulus. It's not stimulus. When the Fed is cutting rates, what they're saying is we're in a recession. I mean, the lowest prolonged rates in U.S. history were during the Great Depression. Low rates are associated with very weak economic growth, deflation, disinflation, and recession. In a prosperous economy where things are growing, interest rates actually go up because they're competing for funds. People say, "Hey, I want to borrow some money, want to issue some bonds because I want to build a new factory, I want to hire people, et cetera." So rates actually go up, not sky high, but 5, 6, 7% because people are borrowing the money and banks are freely lending to expand the economy. When rates come down, say now, by the way, the Fed's behind the curve. Short-term interest rates are collapsing on their own, just in the market. Forget the Fed. Now, so the Fed's going to cut rates on September 18th, probably cut them again in November. There are no more Fed meetings between September 18th and the election. So whatever they do September 18th, that's it until after the election. But they'll probably cut again in November and December, but they're chasing the market down. The Fed's not leading the economy. The Fed's chasing the economy in a very bad way. Gasoline prices are coming down. You're like, hey, isn't that a big victory for Kamala Harris? No, because they're coming down because we're going into a recession. If they were coming down because they were pumping more or had fixed the supply chain or stopped government spending or done something constructive, that's one thing. But that's not what's happening. Prices are collapsing because demand is collapsing. It has nothing, well, very little to do with supply, everything to do with demand. And it's another sign of recession. So I don't want to turn this into an economics lecture, except to say that we may see a stock market crash and we're already seeing sure signs of recession. So my expectation is by mid-October, the economy will be it's already in bad shape, but it'll be apparent to voters in ways it already is, but it'll be more apparent to voters. Unemployment's going up, people are losing their jobs, people are worried about their jobs. So between Russia rolling over Ukraine and the economy collapsing in front of our eyes, those are things that are happening now that are going to be more apparent by October, bigger than, we'll be talking about the debate a couple of weeks from now. They'll be talking about the unemployment rate.
Yeah, that's one thing that in the debate it didn't really Trump might have missed a little bit on just making sure that everyone knew that, I mean, Kamala's the vice president. Biden and Kamala, like this entire economy is under their watch right now, and things aren't looking that great. And yeah, whether we're in a recession right now or gonna be in one, that's a
By the
big
way,
topic.
sorry to interrupt, Matt, but I thought that was his strongest point. I said his weakest point was when he didn't have a good answer on the his plan for affordable health care. He said, "Where is the concept of a plan?" That was a weak moment. His strongest moment was at the very end when they gave each side, I think, 2 minutes to summarize. And he said, "You have all these plans. Why haven't you done it already? You've been vice president for 3.5 years. Why haven't you done it? Why don't you walk off the stage, get on a plane, go to Washington, and sign a bill right now that will actually do some of what you're talking about?" I thought that was powerful. It's like, yeah, you're talking is a good thing, but you are the vice president. You could do something, and you didn't.
Absolutely. Okay, so one more question for you. And again, this is, I know, it sounds like, from your major outlook and big prediction for the election, it sounds like you still see Trump as the winner there in November. I do want to only because I'm starting to see it, it's the mainstream and whatever, but we're getting that feel that things are changing. And I know, so I want to get your opinion on what happens if we wake up on November 6th and Kamala does win. Or I know you have another theory. It's a more of a meltdown theory, which this one's terrifying, that Trump wins the election. And then there's some tricks that the Democrats could do that she ends up becoming president anyway. So I want to go into that for just one more update. What happens if she wins? What would you be looking at from an investment standpoint or doing, what should American families be doing if that's the case? Because I think the mainstream is pushing this out that, oh, she won the debate. So now I think you're going to have a lot of people worried, like, oh no, what if she wins? So what's your answer to that question? What should people, if She happens to win somehow. What should they be doing with their investing, or what should they be doing personally?
Well, great question, Madeline. Okay, let's look at her platform. She doesn't have much of a platform. They just actually put something on the website like 2 days ago, and some tech maven. You can go into, you can get what's called metadata, which is actually you can kind of look behind the curtain of whatever they posted, and they found out it was cut and pasted from Biden's platform. So, they literally took the Biden platform, cut and pasted into her website, and that's her platform. So, some tech. Admin or whatever didn't know what he or she was doing because that was pretty easy to figure out. So no substance at all. But let's look at what she said. Like she has come out with a few positions. She wants to increase corporate income taxes. She wants to increase capital gains taxes. She wants to raise tax rates. By the way, she says we're not going to raise rates on anyone making less than $400,000. Which yeah, it's a lot of money, but I'm sorry if you live in New York City and marry a couple and 400,000, yeah, okay, you're not on the street, but it's not quite as much as it sounds. The rest of the country, yeah. Well, by the way, what I said is in certain pockets of the country, I'm not saying it's not a lot of money. I'm saying it's not as much as you might think if you live in one of these very expensive East or West Coast cities. But here's the thing: they're taking a married couple who make 200,000 each, and they combine them, and then that's 400,000. They're going to get whacked. Those individuals say, "Hey, I make $200,000." Yeah, but if you file a joint return and they're combining them, so when they say they're not raising taxes on anyone making less than 400, it's actually less than 200 if you happen to be married and filing a joint return. So that's a much lower threshold than they've admitted. But just take what and then her we're going to pursue price gouging. I guess the supermarket's working on 1% margin. Okay, let's go after Walmart and other Whole Foods and other Trader Joe's and other department grocery store chains, and let's whack the heck out of them. You know what you get when you put on price controls? Because we know, because we've seen this for 100 years. You get shortages. You get empty shelves right away. You get lines, and you get a black market. People are like, okay, well, I can't sell at a fair price in a normal venue, so find me on eBay or find me at a flea market. Find me somewhere, but I'm gonna basically work outside the system. So you get if you actually want certain things, you'll have to go to a black market, or if you go to the store, the shelves will be partly empty because nobody wants to sell stuff at a loss. Nobody wants to lose money. So it's kind of like East Germany in the 1950s. People get up at 6 in the morning and line up and hope to get a loaf of bread by 5 o'clock at night. That's how they spend their day, in line trying to get one loaf of bread. That's an extreme example, but it's not an uncommon example. And it is what happens when you start putting on price controls. Nixon put on price controls in 1971, and but look where we were by the late then. That led right into a very bad recession, 1974, the worst since World War II, or sorry, since the Great Depression at the time. And then look where we ended up in the late 70s, where the dollar lost 50% of its value in 5 years. So thanks, Kamala. But if I were a stock market investor, I'd sell ahead of her election, or ahead of her administration, because why not? If you can get 20% capital gains instead of 25%, if you can get, again, 22% corporate taxes instead of 28%, I think that's the level she wants to go. That's very bad for stocks, very bad for corporate earnings. Lower corporate earnings are bad for stocks. So you're going to see the stock market turn on a dime and say, "Hey, I'm getting out of here before she becomes president." So you could be looking at shortages of goods, black markets, higher taxes, and lower stock prices. That's the Kamala plan. She doesn't say that. She says we're going to raise all these taxes. Well, I spent the first 10 years of my career as International Tax Counsel, the Citibank. I have a graduate law degree in taxation. I know a little bit about it, and I can tell you what's going to happen, which is stock prices are going to go down. So yeah, I'd be very concerned about that, and I think the market will figure that out. Maybe they are already. Let's look at, to the extent, by the way, today, to the extent that she got a bump from the debate, and I think she did. At least in the minds of observers, you're going to see stock prices go down now, because, like, hey, she's going to ask the same. Investors are going to ask the same question you asked, Matt, which is, what if she wins? The answer is, it's terrible for stocks.
Yeah, and that all
Now,
fits
on
with
the
your
other
meltdown thesis. I mean, we could see a major market move. I mean, we're seeing it just from inclinations that she has a little bit more chance of winning. If she actually
Right.
wins, I think we could see a major market move downward.
And on your other point on the meltdown, that's not far-fetched. That's happening. So now, different question. So Trump wins. Okay, that's my experience. So Trump wins on November 5th when they count the votes, even though they're voting now, gets whatever 260 or maybe as high as 300 electoral votes. You have to go to January 6th, 2025. Everyone's talking about January 6th, 2020. Go ahead to January 6th, 2025. Same scenario. You're in Capitol Hill. The House and the Senate convene. They got to count the electoral votes. Now, on November 5th, we're also going to vote for members of Congress, for the House of Representatives. So whoever counts the votes on January 6th, 2025, is not the existing House. It's the new House. Whoever wins on November 5th, they get sworn in on January 3rd. And then on January 6th, they count the votes. Now, there's a good chance, it's hard to put a stake in the ground, there are 435 seats, but there's a good chance that the Democrats could take the House, even if Trump wins the White House and the Republicans take over the Senate, which I do expect. The Democrats could take the House. So you get to January 6th, that's the new Democratic controlled House. They're going to introduce a resolution saying that Trump is an insurrectionist because of January 6, 2020. They've already written it. Jimmy Raskin, the Democratic congressman from Maryland, de facto communist, he's already written it. He's already talked about this. This isn't like I didn't like break into a safe and steal this. This is kind of out there. So what happens then? If the House adopts that resolution, and if they're Democratic controlled, they will, then Trump's electoral votes are disqualified. He got them. He won, let's say 300. You only need to get 270, but he'll be disqualified under the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. By the way, people say, didn't the Supreme Court say that that doesn't apply? No, the Supreme Court said a state cannot do it. Colorado and Maine were trying to kick Trump off the ballot as an insurrectionist. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. States don't have that power. But they also, and I read the opinion, but they also said, but the Congress could, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, I think you have to go down to Section 4, says, by the way, the Congress can write laws to implement Section 3, and the resolution would be in that category. So now you throw out Trump's electoral votes. What happens then? Well, Kamala Harris doesn't have 270 in this scenario because Trump got more than 270. So the most she could have is, 220, 230, whatever. She doesn't win because she doesn't have 270. Trump doesn't win because he was disqualified. So what happens next? The answer, this is all the 12th Amendment, by the way, which was passed in 1804. The 12th Amendment says that election goes to the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives does not vote by individual, they vote by state delegations. So Texas gets one vote, California gets one vote, New Jersey gets one vote. It doesn't matter how many members you have in the delegation or what the population of your state is, each state gets one vote. You could have the case, probably will be the case, where the Democrats control the majority of the individual votes, but the Republicans control the majority of the state delegations. But you can't vote for Trump because he's disqualified under the insurrection clause. You can't vote for anybody who didn't win a state because the Constitution says take the next three electoral vote getters and you can choose among those three. Well, in what I'm describing, there's only one because RFK, assuming no one else wins a state, RFK Jr., Jill Stein, Cornel West, none of them are going to win a state. So if you disqualify Trump and you say, well, who's left? The answer is Kamala Harris. She's the only one that they can vote for, regardless of who you are. So she becomes the president in that scenario. But J.D. Vance, who is not disqualified, becomes the vice president. So one outcome is you could have a situation where Kamala Harris is the president, J.D. Vance is the vice president. And that has happened before. 1800, Thomas Jefferson, Aaron Burr, they hated each other, two different parties, but one was president, one was vice president. So you could have a Harris J.D. Vance administration. Now I'm going to take it one step further, Matt, because I read the, I am a lawyer. I did take constitutional law, I had a good professor, and I read the 12th Amendment carefully. Everything I just described only applies if there's a quorum. So now let's take it a step further. The Republican state delegations in the United States House of Representatives, pitch a tent and leave the House floor, and they don't have a quorum. What happens now? The 12th Amendment says the vice president becomes the acting president until you guys figure it out. So J.D. Vance could be president.
Well, to say
So
that there's
get.
plenty of things to keep an eye on, but yeah, we've got, I mean, just in between now and the election, you said it. We've got Ukraine, we've got the economy. We're going to keep an eye on that. Then we've got the election itself, which could take a few days to count the votes and all these different things.
Right.
Plus your meltdown theory where, you know, if they disqualify Trump, we could see some big time sparks fly.
Right.
So,
I'll give you one more quickly,
all
which is
right, do it.
if Trump wins on November 5th, the scenario the meltdown scenario is January 6th. But what happens on November 6th, the day after the election? You're going to see riots from coast to coast. The Antifa, BLM, goon squads are already mobilizing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you get this wave, at least in the base on the Democrat side, thinking, oh, she won the debate and they're super happy, and then they don't win and Trump wins the landslide, there will be some anger across the country there. All right, Jim. Well, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule right after the debate here, just so we can get your take on it. We appreciate everything you're doing at Strategic Intelligence. If anybody has anything or wants to learn more about Strategic Intelligence, you can look at the comments below and give us a subscribe, give us a like, and we'll see you next time. Jim, we'll keep you posted. If we can get you back on, if there's anything big happening in between now and November 5th, we'll want you back on soon. So thanks a lot, and we appreciate it.
Thanks.